The Buddha at different times gave quite a big picture view of things in the most expanded sense of this world and other worlds and the visible universe and universes upon universes with millions of suns and moons and planets, on and on, boundlessly, immeasurably. And then spoke of the rarity of life, preciousness of life, and opening people up, opening their body, their mind, their heart. And then he'd begin to, step by step, offer the teachings, foundation of dana, for example, and sila, committing to non-harming. And expanding on that, Brahma Vihara Dhamma practice, unconditional love, compassion, empathetic joy, equanimity. And all along the way, he just listened, attuned to what the audience, who the people were, villagers, his monastics, a few people, one person, 500 like that, and just know when to put things into place that way. When we, as we learn to listen deeply, you know, we're encouraged. We encourage you and ourselves to just take in what we can at any time, whether it's our practice, meditation practice in the Brahma Viharas or Vipassana practice. We're getting instructions, we're listening to talks, and some seems to arrive just in a timely way at the right time and makes sense, settles in the heart, opens the heart, and puts the pieces together for our next step, or brings clarity for what's just been happening. And often as these retreats go on, there's almost like this energy moves throughout this sitting sangha, and this individual, and then like this sort of group energy that takes in and seems to coordinate, seems to harmonize with each other. And you know, whatever Pari, Michelle, or I, whatever we offer, whatever we say, it seems to fit a large number of you at once. That's how the Buddha taught, of course, so much more perfectly and so in tune. And the idea of the big picture was to give people an appreciation, a clarity about being alive, you know, which something we discover in our practice as we refresh our sense of embodiment and the body and the senses. It's like a reset button. We just take it so much for granted, you know. Until then, the ways of learning, which are linear and logical, information based. And there's the volume of conceptual framework helpful for the societal type of living, you know, mega city living that we have been doing for the past few thousand years. But does it take us closer to things as they are? Does it take us closer to feeling what it means, you know, to be alive? trying to keep my attention away from the activities of the country to the south of us in the fall of 2016. You know, I usually, if I'm looking at information, I hit all the buttons that bring me information about nature and science and astronomy. So, you know, I got a hit on this astrophysicist at the University of Nottingham in England. In that period, in that fall of insanity, nobody realizes that the universe expanded tenfold because his data came together that moved the size of the universe from 200 billion galaxies to 2 billion, up to 2 trillion galaxies. So just like overnight, we expanded tenfold. That seemed to me far more relevant than the other shenanigans. And so, you know, I kept reading and pushing links and whatnot, and the quantum physics conference they had around the same time, California, talking about that the space-time fluctuation that happened 13.7 billion years ago, so-called Big Bang. And this is mind-boggling. In a trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, matter and energy came out of nothing. Just expanded out of nothing and still is expanding. So on that scale, 13.7 billion years ago, we're a few minutes or a few hours old. We, Homo sapiens. Just like minutes ago, came out of Africa and populated the world. And then out of the inner darkness, it said the conditions are ripe for Buddhas to appear and illumine, bring light to the inner darkness that of unknowing, you know, of not understanding things, understanding the preciousness of life. So it's like we just haven't been around that long, and as far as we know, we're one of the only one, maybe a couple of species that have this self-reflective gift, that we can turn attention on the immediacy of our experience. But we only do so with the help of someone like the Buddha. For example, for thousands of years, it was known that people understood dukkha, and people understood anatta, anicca, change. Change and dukkha were pretty common, and that there were meditations and concentration practices and yogas and so forth that responded to what was obvious, that life was fairly short, far shorter in those days. Birth, life, death, you know, pretty quickly coming and going. So, and the pain, that's pretty obvious. Heart pain and body pain. And so dukkha was a likely inspiration for various spiritual paths and yogas that apply to that, and changing nature, changing conditions. Even the Brahmaviharas were already being practiced at the time that the Bodhisattva became awakened into Buddha, awakened one, So it's all the more rare when a Buddha comes and teaches a path, a wisdom path to completion, complete liberation. And what he did out of skillful means was gather the kinds of practices that worked well, that he knew worked well. He had tried most of the prevalent ones of the time. And then coming out of his awakening was this, the understanding that only Buddhas bring to a spiritual path. And that's the understanding of anatta, that everything is process. Everything is process, that there's no exception, there's no agency, no entity, no abiding separate self, which was absent in the other teachings. There was, you know, the small self and a big self, and union with the universe, or union with the Brahma, with the God, or, you know, whatever it was. But it was a mirror of one's inner ongoing permanent sense of self on its journey of awakening. And the Buddha couldn't find such a thing. And his liberation came from realizing the realization of what was true. So he did, not like he made up anatta. He just experienced that there's no exception to everything being impermanent. And you take that all the way. If everything is impermanent, of course it's unsatisfactory. It's not reliable. You can't hang on, nothing to hang on to. And that's dukkha. If you take it even further, if everything is indeed impermanent that and uncontrollable, you know, where can there be agency that affects anything? You know, that if that were so, we could just say, be well when we're sick. Live a few extra 100 years, you know, and may I have this and that, and if we had that kind of control, we don't. So then he just put out this path. He put out a path of transformation, which was included the practices already available. He taught about generosity as fundamental to any spiritual evolution and practice. It was ancient already, you know. It arose with our earliest tribal ancestors, and still exists today in indigenous groups around the planet. People in the indigenous cultures know that the first thing you do when you relate to each other is offer something, offer a gift. It's a gesture of connection, of friendliness, of non-harming, of which follows from dana, from that generosity comes non-harming, sila. And the experience of that internalized when we don't cause harm in and around us to other beings, already anxiety falls away. Degrees of anxiety fall away enough that the mind starts to settle. We start to learn how we can relax these formations, physical formations, mental formations, be more at ease. Just from that commitment, that subscribing to honesty and non-harming. And then that allows the Brahma-viharas to come out. Connection. Metta is about connection, friendliness. And the response of metta to pain, personal, family, community, planetary, is caring compassion. The real, authentic compassion that's not dependent on results. That's there regardless of the pain continuing or not. And the heart of metta, that fundamental sense of connection, friendliness, where it touches beauty, art, happiness, fulfillment here in our own heart, in our immediate family, community, planet. The native response of the heart is celebratory, that appreciative consciousness. Oh, wow, that's really lovely. You know, that empathetic resonance of enjoying other people's well-being and happiness and our own, you know, stepping outside and appreciating our own happiness and gifts when we can feel them. And likewise, the equanimities, Brahmavihara equanimity is relational, that balance of being in regard to our most intimate relations and to the planet, to living things, and the understanding that, again, that based on understanding that there's, we may wish for the continuation of friendliness, the cessation of suffering, for everyone to be happy all the time. It's not the way of the world. So that balance is the wisdom response. That very refined and deep balance. So that transformation, it includes all the inner work we do on ourselves, you know, personal, interpersonal, relational, the therapies, yoga, martial arts, Pilates, everything we do to have a healthy sense of ourselves, body, mind, heart, strength, balance, vibrancy, shining, glowing, you know. And that's a good offering. It's as long as we're still alive, whatever way we still can find that balance and goodness in ourselves, manifest that, it just has a tremendous effect on everyone else, as you all are doing here now, you know. Your own practice has had an immense effect on everyone else in this room and at Hollyhock and the creatures around us. Yesterday, the other day, whatever, it was nice. I was walking down the beach and I just noticed, you know, Pari and others have mentioned seeing the deer. I haven't seen any deer. Why haven't I seen any deer yet? And I was sitting down on a log down there and I just heard this rustling around. And I turned around, and right there on the beach behind me, almost within reach, you know, was a beautiful doe. They're unafraid. And it's all these years that we've been here, they know that they're not going to be harmed. So the effects, the impact we have on others is part of the self-transformation. The transcendent element. This is the Buddha's great offering to us. Transformation can include all the samatha or deep concentration practices, the real subtle states of consciousness that can be achieved, and personal magnetic power. So, if one so chooses to have that, are just, you know, a good meditative mind skills, as long as we keep doing it. But identification with that is always a vulnerability. We can still think we're doing it, we're making it happen, we're the ones that are experiencing these subtle states of consciousness, or we have this magnetic power, and so on and so forth. And it's many abuses, as we know, in the spiritual world. So the transcendence part, unique to the Buddhas and anyone like the Buddhas, because the Buddha didn't claim, you know, that the Dhamma path could only be through him. Anyone like him, like, for example, what he called Pacheka Buddha, silent Buddhas, who also self-discover, like Buddhas do. They're called silent Buddhas because we never hear of them, never see them. They find complete liberation, but they're not interested in, they just don't have the spiritual virtues or paramis, the desire, the impulse to teach. So that under that and either in even other things he have said in the scriptures, you get the feeling that he's not teaching this path, only this way we'll do it. And he often said, please don't believe anything I said or any teacher says. Don't go by tradition. Don't go by what you hear, by what you read, or what you reflect upon. Don't go by anything other than go and yourself and sit under a tree or in a hut or at the base of a mountain and see for yourself. You know, take these instructions that help be still and be present and see what happens. So the transcendent part is transpersonal. It's when we get a glimpse or a vision or have an intuition that there's more than birth and death, living and dying. That there's something more. And so when we contemplate the Buddha's big picture of the universe, or today's, you know, astrophysicists and quantum mechanic scientists, and they show this incomprehensible. I mean, when we hear that the universe formed in a trillionth of a second out of nothing, I mean, that's enough for a karmic knot, for me anyway. That's so staggering, you know, I've had that karmic knot for lifetimes. And it's too much. So, yeah, there must be something a little more than being born, existing, and then ceasing to exist. And if there wasn't, I don't think any of us would be in this room. So these two are, they feed each other. Without that healthy, shining, strengthened sense of ourselves, you know, doing the best we can to follow the path of generosity, non-harming, and so forth, the stronger the sense of ourself, the more we're liable to disidentify with experience. And not being identified with experience, there's no attachment, there's no craving, there's no engine underlying why we keep creating suffering, dukkha. So that non-identification comes from, you know, having a relatively, you know, we're still all working on ourselves in various ways, and we come with our wounds and our karmic knots, but we're good enough. We're good enough to do 2 weeks of retreat, or 3 weeks of retreat, or 3 months of retreat, or much longer. And you, if you haven't, you can. We're telling you, you can. You can do these 14 days. You can do, you know, far more. So the good enough strength of ourselves is what allows for these more transcendent insights, where we do have glimpses that have nothing to do with the conventional world. We genuinely step beyond the life and death and the conceptual construction of things. So little insights are like glimpses to that, and the early awakening stages where the body is touched by that light of Nibbana, and we, for a moment, timeless moment, there is no constructed universe. There is no conditional reality. It's just dropped away. And there's no word for it. There's no way really to talk about it because it's so non-conceptual. But it's true. It exists. It's real. And just even some of the potent and poignant early insights give us something that's like it. You know, when we talk about that temporary cessation of dukkha, the dukkha craving cycle, and that where we can just abide and be content and want nothing, and know what it's like to not want anything. Abiding in that for 2 seconds is magnificent. And, you know, 2 seconds every once in a while, and sometimes 3 or 4 seconds or 3 or 4 minutes, it's just quite extraordinary. And that just it builds our faith, that builds our confidence that there is a path. Adding on to the Buddha saying, you don't have to follow any belief system, even the instructions he puts out or the teachings he puts out, that he never said that a samana, you know, a practitioner like us could not come upon the unconditioned insights and the unconditioned by herself or himself. Without the body of the Buddhist teachings. Related to that is the many forms of practice, and I've often given examples in the warrior energy of Upandita, that usually is what how he was perceived. My relationship with him was more unusual in that there was just a deep love between us and care between us and between him and our daughter, you know, who we adored, Chandra. I don't think I could have handled his fierceness, quite frankly, but I was inspired by him, so I had energy that I never knew I had, that I could produce. It was just there, and I trusted everything he said, and I practiced every, tried to be present with such intensity. You know, I overdid it all the time. I'd write down like almost every minute of a 24-hour period, sitting, walking, washing my robes, going to the interview, going to the meals, everything. So I could see, well, where in there might I be missing opportunity to be more aware? And I had broke the 24 hours down into 6 mini days, which is a good thing to do on a retreat, you know, wake up to breakfast or something like that, and, you know, instruction period to lunch. It just feels like I can handle that. You know, that's only 2 sittings and a walking. You know, and then lunch to, well, here, maybe massage, right? And or the walk on the beach. And then, you know, going to the 4 o'clock sit or not, and so forth. Just by breaking it down, it's like, because it's not real anyway. 24-hour cycle is just all imaginary. And so, of course, it's going to seem really, really long at times. So to only have to, I only have 1 day. And then, okay, now it's the next day. I can do that. So without having the time really to go into all the various forms, you know, and so this way, I was inspired to practice the way Upandita liked. He liked energy, he liked intellect, he liked faith. And, you know, that's really led me a lot, Michelle and I began this practice when it was just being, just happening here in the West, just coming, and gave up everything for it. I don't know if it was that much that we had to give up, but whatever we had, it just, we were just touched in such a way, you know, kind of rattled to the core, surrendered to it, just step at a time, and often challenging and difficult, and how to kind of support ourselves and, you know, work and retreat and save and this and that, just to kind of stay as close as we can to the energy of these teachings. And it took me to India, practicing with people who had trained in Burma, and until we were allowed in Burma in the beginning in 1980, 81, if sponsored by a monastery. And, you know, carried when had no idea, our parents are freaking out, you know, what kind of cult are you doing? And sounds like a real, I'd write home, you know, about my day as a monk. My mom would write back and say, oh, Stephen, it sounds like a very Spartan life that you're living, you know. And boy, was she surprised when I was in the front page of the Honolulu Advertiser one morning. I had no idea, you know. I was in Burma. Everyone else had to leave. From Burma, period, all foreigners had to leave. Just as I got a visa, longer story, to come in. So I was the only one at the Mahasi Center. And David Gray, who was then the head of AP, Associated Press Bureau, in Southeast Asia, and he still is. Unless he's retired recently. He still was as of the Saffron Revolution in Burma in 2007. He came, and his assignment was to do an article, why are Westerners coming to Burma to meditate? Well, I was the Westerners in Burma to meditate. And so could he do an interview? Sure. And I wasn't in my budget. I couldn't bring a photographer. I'm not a good photographer. Do you mind if I take pictures, you know, of you doing meditation? So, no, it's fine. I'm doing walking meditation, and he got at a certain angle. And it was months until I heard that it went out, you know, in the New York Times and Michelle's parents, everyone. There I am in monk's robe. I look like I have a cone head by the angle, the shot. My mother was just mortified, you know.
And the schedule.
The schedule?
Of the retreat. Like it had in the Boston Globe, it not only had a full front page, full picture, but it had the schedule of the retreat. And my father looked at it and said, he's working hard.
Very good, Michelle. Continue.
No. Good. Working hard.
So, as you can see, we do the practice to gain integration and stabilization. Stabilize our systems, thoughts, emotions, physical sensations, the flexibility, nimbleness, relative degree of the, you know, integrated, stabilized, you know, calm, and the flexibility, and the concentration that has the staying power, you know, of more than just a fleeting trillions of a trillions of a trillions of a second, that just goes on for a little while, that where we can be mindful and see things that are real, that are felt experience, that are tangible, have texture, mental states, sensations of the body, and thought formations, sounds and other senses, light, fragrance and flavors. And having that, then we start to have the clarity that comes, which is really faith. It's a result of faith. Our confidence builds when we see that it's possible to bring the stabilization. And this is where an example of one of the people, friends I've known who have their own style, own unique style of having how they learned or how they were taught, is an Australian monk who was a hippie in Thailand in the late 70s, early 80s. He wanted to learn meditation, and he ended up at a monastery in the southern part of Thailand, and took robes eventually, a novice, and then higher ordination, and then wanted to learn meditation. So his teacher said, okay. And then the two of them would meet in the hall in the evening, and the teacher would sit, and my friend, Teja Damo was his name, sat, and he waited for any instructions, and no instructions came. The next day, no instructions came, sitting for an hour, gradually increasing, 2 weeks, 3 weeks, 4 weeks, you know, sitting, hour, 2 hours, no instructions. A year went by. And sittings vary between, you know, 1.5, 2, 3, sometimes 4 hours. Sometimes he'd stand. And after a while, he realized that he wasn't going to learn anything. He wasn't going to get any instructions. But what happens is, well, just what happens here? We see how the mind gets tired and sleepy, and sloth and torpor come, and restlessness and worry come. Lots of doubt, desire, you know, wanting in his case instructions, or wanting to get out of the hall, aversion. What is this? You know, why aren't I getting a teaching? Again and again and again, until he experienced that again and again and again. And, you know, some part of his mind began to see what happens when there's just this resistance to stillness. Because it'd be a moment or two of stillness. And then again, anxious or doubtful or wanting or not wanting, sleepy. And gradually, you know, it just, by developing a kind of awareness that he didn't ever realize he had, he just saw and began to understand these formations of mind. The desire, the wanting mind, the not wanting mind, the sleepy mind, the restless mind, the doubting mind, and that they actually were came and went. They weren't, nothing of them was permanent, and there was space between them, and just kept growing that space, and stillness, the stillness defeats time and conceptual space. It just removes them and drops us into this kind of space-time, like mythological space-time, where those laws don't apply. Those conceptual laws don't apply. Everything internally has little to do with the papancha mind, projection, proliferating mind. Papancha happens the moment there's an impingement of light and the eye sensitivity or sound vibrations, the ear sensitivity, thought formation in the mind sensitivity. The very next moment, if we're not mindful, we will have a thought about it. And then another thought, and then a series of thoughts, and then reactions, liking and disliking, and more thoughts, and conceptualization. And then very quickly, within just nano moments, we're living an idea of our experience, a story of our experience. So that pre-papancha, mindful stability is what grew for Tejas Nama. And that's how he developed his meditation. So for those reasons, whenever I go to Sydney, he wants me and other friends to come and teach his classes. He doesn't know how to teach because he was never taught. He can sit with them, but he doesn't know really what to say to them. Just sit, you know. He'd rather have somebody come who, you know, who's at least had some instructions and can share them. What I love about that, it shows that, you know, left alone, the heart knows how to grow itself. The mind knows how to develop. That's what we're doing, and learning what the hindrances are, what the awakening factors are, and what the senses really are, getting just enough instruction, so, and then lots of opportunity to see for ourselves, to practice for ourselves in all four postures and so forth, and making our day our practice, and we really want to make our life our practice, and that this mindfulness move through and with everything that we do, that's aliveness. We learn aliveness. We learn what it means to be real and here and now in this precious formation, whatever it is, whatever it means to be alive in this really strange and mysterious universe. Just talk a little bit about how our touchstones, we just have touched on a little bit, just came up in interviews, come up in interviews, you know, how to use touchstones. So like one yogi said, he really loves coming to Holyoke, and one of those has been coming for decades, and when he wakes up, he just feels peaceful, relaxed, you know, the stillness. Now, as soon as he has a thought about the day, here's a knot. Just clenches. We know that feeling. I know that feeling. when I'm tired and and I have whatever, an appointment to do or a sitting to make, and I wake up and, oh, it's coming out of a dream state and aware of sounds of the morning, of the lapping of the water and stuff like that. And then there's a thought, ooh, I've got it. And then, you know, just the mind racing the things to do and just cringe or tighten or get that little karmic knot or big karmic knot, just depending. Well, that can be a touchstone. You know, that little or big karmic knot right away reminds us, brings us back, not necessarily to the relaxed state and calm state that we initially woke up with, but brings us to what is true and brings us to a conditioning, you know, a momentary freeze of being somewhere and having or even thinking that we have something to do. You know, and instead just, okay, well, feel that reaction. It's like, you know, for me, I relate to it as like that karmic knot from when the universe formed out of nothingness and is expanded and is still expanding. We're an experiment. Like, I think we're somebody's experiment, you know. So that's all it takes for me to have a karmic knot. Or put Iron Man on, you know. But it can be a moment where, okay, you know, and just feeling the dimensions and radius and radiation and intensity and where it is in the body and whatever happens to it, you know, observing it. That's a touchstone. Like, it's okay that it's a karmic knot. doesn't need to go away to be mindful and to be present. In fact, it's a very powerful object to make us present and to see these ancient things that we carry around. Nothing particularly to do at all with the day. And then someone else mentioned, you know, liking the team or companions of compassion and equanimity. And they're a good team in facing fear. And because Michelle has put the fear of sharks in everybody's mind from her story, his fear formation, touchstone, is a shark. The image of a shark represents the fear that he feels. Powerful, quite a big touchstone. But then, you know, I said, you know, our touchstones can be like mental. They're psychoactive. So like to hold the idea of shark in mind and to then experience the fear, because then it's just in the mind, not out in the water where Michelle was, you know, it's just in there. And we give it some formation. We give it an embodiment, kind of set it out there rather than having it feel so like overwhelming our own heart. And then with the companions of compassion and equanimity, we can approach this fear. Fear, again, as a karmic knot, is something we all carry to some degree. And, you know, contrary to what Michelle was saying, all surfers do not paddle in with the presence of a karmic shark. We watch it. We watch it, and if it swims by, why waste, you know, the next 100 really good waves? Only if it starts to circle, you know, and in time we know the behavior of a tiger shark. If it was Australia, it's a different story. The great whites, if you see them anywhere, you get out of the water. They have no formality. So, in the same way, you know, it's like, can we just be with the fear in that way? Can we see that it comes and goes, that's passing? And if not, if it starts to circle around, another strategy might be useful, where we call up a stronger sense of the Brahma-Vihara, like metta, to oppose it, or dismantle it with vipassana, the story part, the emotion part, the psychophysical part, the emotive nature and texture of fear, explore that, ideally through the body with the physical sensations that correlate to the fear, and then pleasant, unpleasant, usually unpleasant, right? Until we're really equanimous, and moments of being really equanimous, it's just fear. Just fear. The mind is equanimous, and that means neutral, neither pleasant or unpleasant. And seeing the fear come and go is insight, seeing that it's impermanent and impersonal. Not my fear, just fear. So we talked about other kinds of ways to, someone mentioned how they, when they walk through the forest, you know, they've been feeling this like total opening up the front of the body and the chest, and just all this joy, like the whole forest, all the elements of joy coming into her, and just displacing the places, the weight of responsibility and difficulty in challenges back at home, you know, in daily life, and feeding off the joy, and talked about how joy is like, it is a nutriment. And the whole path is getting this nutriment of various kinds of joy. So one description of our path is from dukkha, from understanding or feeling or knowing a moment of dukkha, like fear or difficulty of any kind, is a condition for faith to arise. And faith is that it's confidence in ourselves, in the path and the teachings, that the efficacy, you know, it grows, just begins to arise from the first moment of seeing and getting an understanding, even a little understanding of fear. Cause for faith, and faith being the cause for delight. So that when the yogi notices the qualities of delight, and delight is a cause for joy. If we kind of back it up a little bit, we see that we may find that the confidence was there. That trust and confidence in the path was a reason for the delight, and because of the delight, that's a cause for joy to arise. And joy is a cause for tranquility. And that's where the mind sort of just comes together and is still. And tranquility is a cause for sukha, translated as happiness, but it's the experience of ease, contentment, mind not wanting. And mind not wanting, a cause for concentration, that stabilization. Mind stable, mind grounded, mind anchored, mind heart anchored, body, mind unification, experience of samadhi, translated as concentration, or as my Pali teacher once translated, perfectly put together. Those moments, perfectly put together. And from concentration comes wisdom. From wisdom comes realization, cessation of dukkha, realization of the unconditioned. So the joy, someone else said, well, can I just make joy happen? And I said, yes. Yes, we can. I'll tell you how in a minute. This is a poem from Holly Hughes called Mind Wanting More. Only a beige slat of sun above the horizon, like a shade pulled not quite down, otherwise clouds. Sea rippled here and there, birds reluctant to fly. The mind wants a shaft of sun to stir the gray porridge of clouds, an osprey to stitch sea to sky with its barred wings, some dramatic music, a symphony perhaps, a Chinese gong. But mine always wants more than it has. One more bright day of sun, one more clear night in bed with the moon. One more hour to get the words right. One more chance for the heart in hiding to emerge from its thicket in dried grasses. As if this quiet day with its tentative light weren't enough. As if joy weren't strewn all around. So I said, strew joy all around. You know, your favorite old pair of jeans, your old shoe with holes in them, favorite book, you know, picture, photograph, a rock, flowers, just all around the place, wherever you want. Just all the touchstones. Every symbol of joy that you can imagine. Put them all over the place and see. Does the mind want more? I feel like Michelle here, you know, just. So why do we like faith? I'll end with this little bit. Why do we like faith? Faith, confidence, ultimately unshakable trust. When we've had an awakening experience. Well, we like faith, as Upandita said, all of practice is the awakening and strengthening of faith, and which took me a long time to experience that. Well, we like it because it brings, one of the things it brings is tranquility and clarity. Right? When we gain a little confidence, when we see that it's like dropping into a current, you know, with the flow of things, something you'd know, you know, as a surfer or skater or skier or dancer, martial artist, writer, artist, speaker with other people, just those moments where it's just all working by itself, not doing anything. The kind of ease, tranquility, calm, and clarity that brings. That's because of faith. It's like described, Upandita would describe it as a water purifying gem. In ancient India, maybe today too, it was just some kind of stone put in rock and water, and all the sediment would fall to the bottom. So it works like that. It's like a gem that just sort of purifies all the dust, everything stirred up in the mind, just falls away. You know, goes. Cleanse, like the way when moving water cleanses itself. The second thing, I mean, from that clarity, of course, comes insight, vision. We get a sense of where we're going. As Mao, the indigenous man who taught non-instrument navigation again 40 years ago and helped the whole resurgence of Polynesian nation, their heritage, their spirituality, their dance, everything. He said to my friend Nainoa Thompson, who was training as the first navigator in 600 years, when they were standing on a cliff looking out over the horizon, Mao said, "Nainoa, can you see Tahiti?" That's where they were sailing. And over 3,000 kilometers over the curvature of the earth. And Nainoa said, "I see it in my mind." And Mao said, "Good. Keep the vision of the island in mind. And you will pull it out of the sea." That's part of the ancient lore and tradition of Polynesian navigators. They'd hold a vision here, just below the navel, of where they were going, and then pay attention through all their senses to the turbulent systems, meaning everything, you know, wind, weather, ocean currents, color of the horizon, stars, everything. Pay attention with every bodily feeling and sense receptor that brings it all in. Pay attention, and then you pull Tahiti out of the sea. So that vision comes, and it strengthens our faith. And the second, first is the tranquility and clarity. The second is this sense of leaping forward, or venturing spirit. It's such a great adventure, however we got here. in that trillionth of a trillionth of a trillionth of a second, to look at consciousness, which itself seems boundless, immeasurable, and infinite, even without the metta and the compassion. All the more so with it, with the boundless nature, metta, compassion, joy, equanimity. So that's an adventure of consciousness to discover and see that the very looking, the very observation, the very awareness is what purifies, like the water purifying gem. And that's how we touch the one thing that is not impermanent. The unconditioned. Let's sit a moment. May we all be able to abide in the joy strewn all around us.